So I'm in a car, and it's going upwards of 100 miles an hour on a rural dirt road. It's starting to fishtail. You know, sometimes when you're in a difficult situation, time slows down, and you're able to kind of look around and take stock of things, even though everything's moving really fast. And what I notice, I look to the driver, and his foot is squarely on the accelerator, and we're going faster. And the thing that's scaring me is he's not even looking through the windshield. His head is back, and he's using every swear word in the English language that I've ever heard. And I'm his boss. He's been working for me for about a year. And the two women in the back, the people he's berating, are reporters that work for me. And I finally get him to slow down the car. We're okay. We're pulled over to the side of the road. And I can feel his heartbeat. I can feel his anger. He's livid, and the women are crying, and he turns to me and he says, "Don't say a word," and we're just silent. We have no idea what he's going to do next. And how did we get to this point? I moved to Sri Lanka in 2007 to run a project, a humanitarian newswire for people who are fleeing the war zone, and basically I hired and trained a bunch of reporters, local people, and we traveled in a van along the periphery of the war zone, and we met with the displacement population. And we gave them news and information that they could learn from and improve their situation. So we spent most of our time on the road together. We were this tight-knit unit. And Omar, the driver, was my best friend. He was Butch Cassidy and I was Sundance. And in this moment, I knew that that had changed. I didn't know what was going to happen next, but I knew I'd probably have to fire him for what had happened, which I still didn't understand. So the women were unwilling to get back in the car with him, and I had to send them back all the way across the country to our home base in Colombo and drive back with him in total silence. And we had a hearing at my office, and my boss had it, and I 20 minutes, I explained how I saw what had happened. And Omar came dressed up, he had glasses, which I'd never seen him wear before, and he had this stack of papers. And over the course of a few hours, he went through every mistake I'd made over the course of a year. And by the end, I mean, this is my best friend, and I was hurt, you know, like this guy had just torn me a new one in front of my boss. And if I'd have been the boss, I probably would have fired me after that. But we had to move forward. And what I found out was Omar was Muslim, and I'd been favoring these women in his mind, in part because if you know anything about the civil war in Sri Lanka, they pioneered suicide bombing, and often the suicide bombers were women. And so when we'd go to the areas that were sensitive, the women who worked for me were scrutinized more than the men. So I was protective of them, and Omar saw that as favoritism. So that just kind of added over the course of the year. It made him really upset. And so it came out in that day, in that moment. We couldn't fire him, I was told. So we went back out on the road without the women. And we kept doing our work. And there's this moment in February of 2009 where I'm sitting at a cafe with a spokesperson for the United Nations. And in the middle of that, I got a text message. It was from a friend at the U.S. Embassy, and it said, "Your name's on the front of the paper. You know, you're getting kicked out." And I headed back to my office, and the person greeting me there with the front page of the newspaper was Omar. And he translated it for me, and all the details were wrong, my name, who I worked for, what I was doing there. But it was very clear I had 72 hours to leave. And I couldn't tell if Omar was holding up the newspaper as kind of a final, like, I won. So it was, I wasn't sure in that moment. And what he said to me after he translated it was, he said, "It's okay. Like, we're gonna figure this out." And there was a little bit of wink in it, and I knew, like, we were teammates again. You know, he was on my side. And so we made up. 48 hours, I'm pleading my case, and it comes to the last day, and it's clear that I have to leave. There's been more articles about me. Somebody put my photo in the paper, which is a bad sign there, because journalists disappear in Sri Lanka. So I have to leave. And Omar says, "I want to take you to the airport," and I'm flying to Bangkok. And he picks me up, and it's hot, like here at night, you know, midnight, it's still this hot. And sitting in the passenger side seat is this little gift wrap present. So I unwrap it, and it's a Valentine's Day chocolate that says, "I miss you." And it's melting in the night heat, and Omar's staring at me, he's not saying anything. And it's clear he wants me to eat it in front of him to validate the gift. So I eat it, and my hands are covered in milk chocolate, and I'm like, okay, he's happy. And we drive in silence to the airport, and we get there, and he hops out of the car, And he walks over, and again, a very conservative, you know, quiet guy in a lot of ways, and he grabs me in this bear hug. And he's sobbing, and he's about 5'4", so he comes up to my chin. So his head is buried in my chest, and everyone at the airport's watching us. And when finally I peel him off me, my shirt has this indentation from his beard. It's like a sponge or something. And I go into the airport, and I go through security, and I look back, and his face is up against the glass. He's still watching me. And so I go. I may never go back, but I'm thankful for that moment. Thanks. I'm